Today, 18 months after the Windrush scandal, why are the victims still waiting for compensation from the government? And in opinion, Polly Toynbee on a manifesto that Labour hopes will shake up the election. Hubert Howard moved to the UK from Jamaica in 1960, aged 3.
He was cool, man. He was coolness personified.
That's Hubert's friend, Tyrone. And this is his daughter, Marisha.
You can see that he still kept his culture. He used to play Bob Marley, Dennis Brown, reggae, revival. Music was his life.
Hubert was, by all accounts, a real character. Tyrone remembered his outlandish dress sense.
That's him there. He's wearing a black jacket and a trilby sort of hat, black suede shoes and purpley-grey pair of trousers and a yellow polo shirt. He's just a snazzy dresser.
It sounds as if Hubert was pretty happy. He had a good job. But in 2012, the Home Office's hostile environment policy changed everything for him. He was told he wasn't a citizen of the only country he'd ever really called home.
From the 70s, I've been working up till now. And to think that I have to prove myself that I'm a citizen of this country. But I'm very, very, very angry. It's ruined my life, completely ruined my life.
Despite years of fighting, it was only when Guardian journalist Amelia Gentleman brought the Windrush scandal to national attention that Hubert's case was re-examined by the Home Office.
Thousands from the so-called Windrush generation have fallen victim to recent attempts to tighten immigration laws.
I am today announcing a new dedicated team that will be set up to help these people evidence their right to be in this country and access services.
That should have been the end of this for Hubert and the many other Windrush victims. But instead, the Home Office only granted him citizenship last month when he was critically ill. Hubert died last week, still waiting for compensation. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, why is the government still failing Windrush victims like Hubert Howard? Amelia Gentleman and our producer Hannah Moore recently went to see Tyrone to talk about his friend Hubert.
I first met Hubert probably in about 1973/74. I'd grown up in children's homes and so on. And then I was at the time living in a hostel in Tottenham. And it was sort of like home from home because majority of them were Jamaican.
And you, like Hubert, arrived in London from Jamaica as quite a young child.
Yeah, I personally came here in 1964. I was probably 5 years old.
A new nation is born. The island of Jamaica, for 307 years a British possession, welcomes Princess Margaret and the Earl of Snowdon here to represent Queen Elizabeth at independence ceremonies.
After independence in 1962, Jamaica became quite violent. And my grandmother decided it was best to get the family out of Kingston. And some came here and some went to America.
And Hubert had quite a similar experience. He came in
1960. He came in 1960 as a three-year-old on his mother's passport.
And he and Hubert shared a lot of their difficulties over the last few years.
I was under the impression that we were British citizens simply by being here and growing up here. We didn't realise the extent of the problem that would come.
Hubert had a daughter. Her name's Marisha. She's 29.
He used to say, Marisha, don't take any rubbish. Stand up for yourself. Be strong. So he used to give me maths questions, and if I got one wrong, you have to do all over again. And
how did you first come across Hubert?
So I've been writing about this very complicated Home Office problem for a couple of months, and I was trying to talk to as many people as possible.
I haven't stopped for morning. and I'm still going on.
First of all, I'd met a woman called Paulette Wilson, who'd been in Britain for 50 years and was told that she was here illegally and was detained and told that she was going to be deported back to Jamaica.
When I got the letter, I thought, am I British? What am I? And I couldn't even answer that in my head.
As soon as we published her article, I was contacted by a man called Anthony Bryan, who'd put me in touch with some of his friends who'd also been told that they were here illegally, and one of them was Hubert. Hubert was really angry when I went to see him. I met him in North London, trying to understand why it was that he hadn't been able to persuade the Home Office that he wasn't an illegal immigrant.
So it's like I'm knocking my head against a brick wall all the time. You know, and I'm telling you, it drives you crazy. My letters, what they're sending from the Home Office. You see what I mean?
The Windrush generation, people who initially came from Commonwealth countries in the late 40s all the way up to 1970, were welcomed here. Nobody had ever questioned their right to be here. How did they suddenly get caught up in this?
Well, as you say, they'd been welcomed here. Many of them had been invited here by recruitment campaigns, by London Transport and by the Health Service.
They've come to seek work in Britain and are ready and willing to do any kind of job that will help the motherland along the road to prosperity.
It was only later, as immigration law began to get tightened, that they found themselves having been kind of silently illegalised. When the coalition government tried to start getting net migration down, there was a whole series of hostile environment measures brought in that made it much more difficult to operate in the country if you didn't have physical documentary evidence proving that you were living here legally.
Our changes to policy have already brought net migration down by a third. But we're carrying on.
You mentioned the hostile environment brought in by Theresa May when she was Home Secretary under, as you say, the coalition government, the Conservative Party and the Lib Dems together. What did it actually mean?
David Cameron had announced that he wanted to get net migration down to the tens of thousands. So what they did was effectively to begin outsourcing some of the roles of the Home Office to health service workers, to local councils, to employers, so that immigration checks were introduced into everyday life in a way that had never really happened before.
And this is not just about making the UK a more hostile place for illegal migrants. It is also about fairness.
When did Hubert find out he was in trouble?
He first found out when he wanted to go and visit his mother in the early 2000s. She'd retired back to Jamaica and was very unwell, and he tried to get a passport so that he could go and visit her. He'd never had a passport before because he'd never been on holiday. He'd never left the country since arriving as a three-year-old.
Unfortunately, because he didn't have any passport or documentation, he was unable to travel. I think he did contact the Home Office at the time.
It turned out that the Home Office didn't have any paperwork on him. They said they didn't have any record of him. They said if he wanted to go and visit his mother, he could, but that there was no guarantee that he'd be allowed back into the country.
After 40, 50 years of living in the UK, to go back to Jamaica is like, what are you going back to? The only thing I know about Jamaica is what I've seen from watching like YouTube videos and stuff like that.
He didn't have any memory whatsoever of Jamaica. He didn't remember what it smelt like. He didn't even have any vague memories of the landscape or nothing. So he decided not to go. His mother died and he didn't see her again.
So he's prevented from leaving the UK to go and see his mother because when he first came to Britain, he travelled on her passport, which was entirely legal. But now he's in a situation where the government's saying he has to prove he has the right to be here. What did he do?
He spent years gathering paperwork. He went back to his old primary school. He got primary school records. He got his old healthcare records. Just imagine how difficult that is, trying to dig up bits of paper that place you in this country for every year going back to the 1970s. He came into The Guardian on one occasion. We sat in the canteen for 45 minutes and I went through all of his paperwork with him.
Right. What this country needs is education. They need some black history. That's what it's like. It's like we're an easy target.
He was very, very cross and upset about what had happened to him.
Right now, I can't open up a bank account. I can't say I'm going to get anything. I can't do nothing. I can't function without a bank account.
But he was also somebody who liked to make people laugh. He made jokes with me. He made jokes with my colleague, Gary Young, who came down to say hello.
All right, Gary. Nice to meet you. And who's it?
Certainly, Tyrone said that he spent a long time trying to help Hubert to sort his paperwork out, without any success.
We used to speak on the phone probably every couple of days. Often he'd phone me and he'd be near enough in tears.
Tell me about his job.
He worked for the housing association Peabody. He'd worked there for a long time. Hubert really had felt that he'd made a difference to people's lives. So he was working with lots of really vulnerable people in this housing association block. And he wasn't just working there as a caretaker. He was really dealing with people who were having difficulties in their lives.
It was like the best thing that happens to him in his life. He was able to buy things for the family and provide. Yeah, he was very happy.
By 2012, the pressure on employers to do checks had really intensified. And there was a spot check done on his employers. And although his employers were really apologetic, they explained that they just couldn't keep him on because he couldn't prove that he was living here legally.
When he was working, he'd borrowed, I think, 16,000 from the bank in various different loans. So when he became unemployable, he was unable to pay back those loans. He then had bailiffs come looking for him, and it was just stressing him to the max.
As a grown man, he felt he lived like a child. He was just dependent on handouts.
Hubert told me that at some point his financial situation got so complicated that his friends were having to buy him clothes, and he was angry about that.
The thing about it, Amelia, is Hubert was always a very proud person. He's worked all his life. He liked clothes, he liked dressing, and he liked to dress well. He went from a stage where he was able to buy anything he wanted to a stage where he had no income.
And he was unwell, wasn't he?
He'd had leukemia for a long time, but he began to neglect his health and really began to deteriorate. And both Marisha and Tyrone connect his worsening health with the difficulties he was going through at the hands of the Home Office.
We saw him mentally, what he was going through. He started to sleep in the day, wake up at night, and said, oh, I forgot my appointments, because he had so much appointments from the doctors. So he started to just go into depression.
Amelia, your reporting caused a huge scandal.
This is a day of national shame.
More victims came forward. There was a huge emotional response.
Windrush, here to stay.
And then pressure building massively onto the government.
Can she apologise properly?
I mean, extraordinary. It resulted in the resignation of Home Secretary Amber Rudd.
I bitterly, deeply regret that I didn't see it as more than individual cases that had gone wrong that needed addressing.
Sajid Javid replaced her. What did he do?
He was, from the beginning, incredibly apologetic about what had happened.
The most urgent task I have is to help those British citizens, you know, that came from the Caribbean, the so-called Windrush generation.
And he said this was something that he felt could have happened to his mum or dad, it could have happened to him. He really, on the surface, appeared to feel very strongly that this was an issue that he wanted to sort out.
I think there will be lessons to learn about how that compliant environment policy is actually implemented.
He did a number of very, very concrete things. He said that he wanted to see a fairer and more compassionate institution.
A less hostile one.
A less hostile one. He rebranded the hostile environment as the compliant environment. He launched a review into what went wrong, a lessons learnt review, and he promised a huge compensation programme.
Hello, I'm Martin Ford, independent advisor for the Windrush Compensation Scheme.
That looked like it could pay out anywhere between 200 million and 570 million to the people affected.
Individuals will be able to claim for a wide range of losses.
That compensation money, do we know how many people were supposed to be in line for it?
We don't know. And actually, the numbers of people affected is still something of an unknown. Although we do now know that over 8,000 people applied for and have been given documentation of some sort, and the vast majority of them have now got citizenship. So to begin with, I think I felt incredibly optimistic about the potential for there to be real change and for the people who've been affected to really get their lives back together.
And after that, his employer, Peabody, got in touch with you. Tell me about that.
They sent me an email saying that they wanted to offer him his job back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I phoned him to let him know.
They want to give him my job back?
Yeah. I'm going to read you the email. That was one of the best moments, I think, in all of this reporting.
It's such amazing news. I almost cried when I got that email just now. I couldn't believe it. Yeah. Anyway, let me know. Let me know what happens.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Bye.
Sounds like you really live this story.
Yes, I've been thinking about it now for almost 2 years. I've interviewed dozens of people affected. I've written a book about what went wrong. And I think more than most of the journalism I've done, this has been something that's really affected me.
At the time, what did Hubert make of it? Did you talk to him about it?
Yeah, I went with him to Luna House, which is the Home Office headquarters in Croydon. And amazingly, the Home Office let me go in and write an article about the processing of his case. The officials were apologetic. They looked at his papers and they said within an hour that they were going to give him a biometric card that stated that he was here legally.
Yeah. How do you feel now?
13 years I've been on this, and all the time, when I was at my workplace, I was worried about losing my job. Then eventually I ended up losing my job.
So on the one hand, that was a really positive day for him. But on the other hand, he ended up in tears. I think tears of frustration more than anything else, that he'd seen how easy it was for the Home Office to sort out his situation.
It's just been painful for me. It's been painful for others because I know I've upset a lot of people because of this. Because of arguing and all that, you know. The worst thing that's happened to me in my whole entire life is that my mother passed away and I couldn't stay by her graveside. Oh, boy.
So only when it became a scandal did they do what they should have done from the beginning.
Yeah. A year on, it began to be obvious that the pace of reform was very, very slow. So although we've had apologies from a number of Home Secretaries now, we're on to our third, the hostile environment legislation is all still in place and there's no discussion about even tweaking that. The lessons learnt review hasn't been published and really things have stayed the same. The Home Office says that it's begun to pay out some compensation payments, but I'm in touch with a lot of grassroots organisations who represent people who've been affected by this. And I haven't come across anyone who's received any compensation yet.
Nobody?
No. Certainly, of all of the people that I've written about, I don't know of anybody who's received it. And the people claiming compensation, they're claiming it because they have mostly been pushed into serious financial difficulties as a result of the Home Office's actions. And people are getting older. There have been a number of people who I've written about who have died in the last year without getting compensation. And it's just very upsetting to see these promises being made and not realised.
How did Hubert end up being granted his citizenship?
He was determined to go on fighting for it. Even when he got really ill, his lawyer came and visited him at his bed in intensive care.
The last time I saw him in intensive care, he had about four or five different needles in the jugular vein on the right side of his neck. And he was just wired up to a machine like crazy, man. I was like,
and they were trying really until last month to sort things out. It was only when his lawyer told the Home Office that he was critically ill that finally a U-turn was made and he was granted citizenship about 3 weeks before he died.
Do you know who told him about that?
His daughter Marisha showed him the letter.
and I said, congratulations, you've got your citizenship. And he just looked not bothered because he's just given up the fight. But he said, Marisha, pursue it, you know, fight on my behalf.
That's so sad. Mm. He's on his deathbed, and that's when they do it, when they know that this is completely unjust.
Yeah.
Coming here was good. You know, you leave Jamaica, you go into England, everybody's excited, but the reality of living here is a different thing. I'm just sorry for his loss because he was a real good friend. My best friend and probably my only real good friend.
You said that Hubert was in debt. I mean, what does that mean for his family now?
Even the practical issue of organising a funeral has proved to be very difficult. Marisha is crowdfunding for the funeral costs to be covered, and the family has approached the Home Office to see whether they'll make an emergency payment to help.
One of the last things Hubert said to me, I want my money, i.e. his compensation that he thinks he's due from the government, along with a sincere apology. As I've said to Amelia before, I think they're just dragging it out. They know most Windrush victims are around 60-ish, and they're just hoping that we die off before they have to pay anybody anything.
That was Tyrone, Marisha and Amelia Gentleman, who, as you can hear, has done some incredible reporting on the Windrush scandal. Amelia's book, The Windrush Betrayal, published by Guardian Faber, is out now. We contacted the Home Office for a statement. They said Hubert's compensation claim is being progressed and that they'll be in contact with the family. They sent their condolences. Coming up, Polly Toynbee on the most radical Labour manifesto for a generation. Now, yesterday saw the release of the long-awaited Labour Party manifesto. It's big and it is bold, but will it persuade enough voters to back Jeremy Corbyn?
Labour's manifesto is a manifesto for hope.
This is a milestone manifesto. It does go right to the heart of some of Britain's deepest and most long-standing problems. But above all, it begins to repair all of the damage that's been done in the last decade. The most important thing about this manifesto is that it really does tackle the climate crisis. By far the most important thing that confronts us all, its green industrial strategy is clever because it's both an economic strategy for rebuilding industries, green industries in the old industrial areas that have been so depleted since the Thatcher years, creating a million jobs, but also retrofitting old houses to make sure that we get rid of gas boilers, we insulate houses, and we save carbon emissions in a sufficient amount to make a real difference. 150,000 council and housing association homes per year is a big step up. Even so, let's put that in perspective. Is that astoundingly radical? Well, not if you look back to Harold Wilson, Harold Macmillan. They both managed to build 350,000 council houses a year during their time in office. We can at least recreate the ambition of those years. After all, this country is far richer, many multiples of times richer than it was back in the two Harolds day. It's very odd that we should have become so reluctant to be ambitious in policies of this kind, in big investments, compared to how we used to be. The refurbishment of public services is a very urgent necessity, so urgent that Boris Johnson realises that he has to do something, so he's chosen the most popular ones, such as police and the NHS, but not putting all that much in, certainly not enough to repair the damage that's been done in the last 10 years. Labour's plans really would rebuild those services, also would pay public servants properly, because At the moment, their pay has fallen way back over this last decade, and we need to attract people into those sectors, good people, and you'll only do that if you pay them at least as much as the private sector pays. It's a retail manifesto. It has something for everyone. It has plenty for pensioners, plenty for students, plenty for young people, including free buses up to the age of 25. It's very well costed, but it also has left out some of the more radical things that were voted on a bit rashly by the Labour Party in its conference. For instance, public schools are not going to be abolished. They're simply going to have to pay VAT on fees. And there isn't going to be open borders. We're just going to hold on to freedom of movement with Europeans both ways, which I think is popular these days. This is an exciting manifesto. I think it'll give quite an electric jolt to the whole campaign. I think it'll shake up Tory complacency. They're going to be challenged to be anything like as interesting as this, or indeed as problem-solving as this. The problem for Labour always is, have they got the heft to convince people that they have the authority and the competence to carry through such a big programme? It's still quite a big mountain to climb, but I think this manifesto makes it a whole lot more likely.
Vote for this manifesto of hope. It's time for real change. Thank you.
That was Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee. Do read her column at theguardian.com. My thanks to Amelia Gentleman, Tyrone, Marisha, and to Polly Toynbee. Today's episode was produced by Hannah Moore and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Have a lovely weekend, and we'll be back on Monday.